All right, thank you. We're going to begin this evening in Daniel chapter 9 and use Daniel's prophecy in chapter 9 to kind of structure the rest of the content of this evening's discussion. In Daniel chapter 9, this is the great prophet Daniel. Much of Daniel has great historical prophetic significance, chapter 2, 5, 7. A lot of material there that looks forward in history to the events that would transpire between the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Romans and the Greeks, or the Greeks and the Romans. But when we come to chapter 9, something it begins here that's important for our purposes tonight. And so I'm going to begin reading in chapter 9 and just the first three verses to start. In the first year of Darius, son of Xerxes, a Mede by descent, who was made ruler over the Babylonian kingdom in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood from the scriptures, according to the word of the Lord given to Jeremiah the prophet, that the desolation of Jerusalem would last 70 years. So I turned to the Lord God and pleaded with him in prayer and petition, in fasting, and in sackcloth and ashes. And I prayed to the Lord my God and confessed. Now, beginning in verse 4 and continuing on down through verse 19, we have recited here Daniel's great prayer. We can sort of hold that to the side for this evening, but I would encourage you, if you ever need to know what a great prayer looks like, this prayer, Daniel chapter 9, is the prime example. This is a beautiful example of coming to the Lord in confession, but relying also on the promises that he made. But Daniel here says that he remembers the prophecy made by Jeremiah in chapter 25 about the 70 years that the Jews would be captives in Babylon. And so now Daniel, who's been in Babylon all these years, remembers this now and prays to the Lord that they might be released from Babylon and taken back to their own country. And that's what's going to happen here. And so Daniel makes this great prayer. And then we come down to verse 20. And beginning in verse 20 through 27, we see the content of what we want to talk about this evening. While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and making my request to the Lord my God for his holy heal, while I was still in prayer, Gabriel, the man I had seen in the earlier vision, came to me in swift flight about the time of the evening sacrifice. He instructed me and said to me, Daniel, I have now come to give you insight and understanding. As soon as you began to pray, an answer was given, which I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed. Therefore, consider the message and understand the vision. And beginning in verse 24, this is a vision. 77s are decreed for your people and your holy city. And notice there's six things here. To finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know and understand this. And here we're going to get to some future historical events. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, who's Christ, the ruler comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt in the streets in a trench, but in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolation have been decreed. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7, and the he of verse 27 we'll talk about. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on a wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. And so this passage of Daniel chapter 9 will structure much of what we want to talk about tonight. Now, in the handout I gave you, there's two sides to it. We're looking at Daniel's 70 weeks, this chart to begin with. And in reading this passage we just did, we see this chart I drew up this afternoon, and Betty told me that she'd be grading the artistic merit of it, so I rewrote it to try and make it better for us. But there's a 1 week of seven, which seven is years, and so 1 week of seven is 49 years, and then a second time period of 62 sevens, which is 434 years. And that combined gets us a number of 483 years. And so on the chart there, you see the 7 years of weeks and then the 62 weeks of years, those two parts to it before we get to the cross. And that cross then comes at the end of the 62 weeks of seven, or the 69 total weeks we have, is this beginning part of this prophecy. Now, that's what we're going to talk about. So that's the chart. And I did a little bit of the math to the lower left, 483 years times 360 days per year, because that's how Jews counted days in a year, 30-day months, and we'll see that in Revelation. But that gets you 173,880 days. Now, let's just talk about what we have here. So Daniel has this prophecy. And Gabriel comes to him, so he's reading Jeremiah, and he sees in Jeremiah this prophecy that it will last for 70 years. Jeremiah says, the whole country will become a desolate wasteland, talking about Israel and Judea, and Jerusalem in particular, in the captivity. So the Assyrians took the northern tribes in the year 722 BC, the Babylonians took the southern tribe of Judah, and beginning in the year 605 BC, and carried them away. So now the Israelite nation's in captivity in Assyria and dispersed. The Babylonians overtake the Assyrians and carry away the southern kingdom. So basically now Israel is no more. The southern kingdom is in captivity in Babylon. They're taken away. But Jeremiah, we know, escaped from that when Jerusalem fell in about the year 586. Jeremiah the prophet escaped down to Egypt. So that's where he lived out his days, in Egypt. But he writes this prophecy, and again in chapter 25, verse 11 says, this whole country will become a desolate wasteland, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. But when the 70 years are fulfilled, I will punish the king of Babylon and his nation and land of the Babylonians for their guilt, and will make it desolate forever. So on the one hand, God uses Babylon to punish Israel, but then on the other hand, punishes Babylon for punishing Israel. And he does that by bringing in the Medes and Persians. And so we'll see the Persians, Darius, come along and overcome the Babylonians. And so if you enjoy secular history, there's really a lot of great history that goes on here between the time of the Assyrians, and then you get to the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans. All of this is just a very fluid situation. But in this one time period, we have a promise made that that the Israelites will be restored back to their land. And so chapter 29, Jeremiah 29, verse 10 to 14, is even more specific. It says that when the 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will come to you and fulfill my gracious promise to you, to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope in the future. And he goes on for there. So again, Jeremiah makes this very specific here. And you may have heard those words before, because they're often taken out of context in churches. You know, plans to prosper you is prosperity theology. Remember now, this is talking a prophecy made to the Israelites that they'll be returned to their land one day. And so Daniel's prophecy is about these 490 years. We have 70 weeks, and I just drew this up here, changed the chart from last week briefly. We're going to talk about the 70th week here, but it's separated by the church age from the 69 weeks that precede it. And so we'll get the 69 weeks, the first 69 weeks, to the left of the cross. The church age intervenes, and then the 70th week picks up after that. So that's what our chart is illustrating as well. Now let's talk about these 77s, and Daniel lays this out for us. So we have 490 years, and it's divided into these three parts. The first 49 years the next 60, the first 49 or 7 sevens, then the next 62 sevens or 434 years, and then the last seven. So when interpreters come to this passage of Daniel, there's many ways in which it's read and understood. On the one hand, you have, I guess we could say, those who see in it a promise of the coming Messiah, the anointed one, as Daniel says, or we could call it a Christological interpretation. This is our view that reads it as a true prophecy of what Daniel, by Gabriel, says will happen in the future. And we're going to see how, in fact, it does happen. The 69 years are past, or the 69 sevens are past to us. Future to Daniel, but they're now history to us. That's one view, a Christological view. Then there's a non-Christological view, and that might be in two ways. First, there's the liberal view, which doesn't believe it's a true prophecy at all. They may date Daniel hundreds of years later. We date Daniel, current with Daniel, so in about the year 586 or in that time period, the 500s, the late 500s, or the lower 500s, when Daniel would write this to describe these events in his life, 535 or so. Other liberal scholars want to date this book later, even into 200 BC or 150 BC, after the exile, very late. And the reason they want to do that is because the prophecies of Daniel prior in chapter 2, 5, and 7, and 8, talking about the future kingdom, the prophecy of the statue. We don't have time to go into all that this evening, but the head, the chest, the legs, the feet of iron and clay, all of that clearly lays out, it appears, what in fact does happen with the Babylonians, the Medes and Persians, the Greeks and the Romans. And they want to push the date of Daniel later so that they can say that Daniel's just telling us history to Daniel. But if the date of Daniel is much earlier, then it's not history to Daniel, it's prophecy from Daniel. But be that as it may, we get now to this 70th week, and we'll see where even them late dating Daniel doesn't help with this. The other view, conservative view, that doesn't take this literally is the amillennial view, and we'll talk about them in particular next week when we talk more about the millennial views. So today we're talking about Daniel 9, the 70th week, and the portion of the prophecy of the tribulation. So we have Daniel laying out these weeks. Now, six things happen that Daniel 9 talks about in this passage. These six things, there are really two groups of three. There's two groups of three things each that happens. So let's again look at this in chapter 9 and verse 24. Seven sevens are decreed for your people in your holy city, to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, and to atone for wickedness. And so we see these first three things being discussed, and then the second three things, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up a vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. These three aspects will separate out. The first three talk about God does in terms of sin. To atone for wickedness. To finish the transgression is to bring an end to Israel's sin. To atone for wickedness. All of these ideas are contained there. The last three speak towards the future and what will happen when the kingdom is established. And so Jeremiah's prophesied these 7 years of captivity. Those we see as being literally fulfilled when the Jews under Darius are released and they go back to Jerusalem. They rebuild the walls, they rebuild the city, they rebuild the temple. And if that 70-year prophecy is literally fulfilled, we have reason to think that Daniel's 490-year prophecy will likewise have a similar or same type of literal fulfillment. So in Daniel, we're looking for a future restoration. And what Daniel's talking about here is a restoration of the people back to their land. But once they get there then, that's what Jeremiah's talking about, a restoration of the land. Daniel's talking about the final restoration of the Jews in God's kingdom. And that's where these second three aspects come in. To bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. That we get at the end during the millennium when the kingdom is set up. And so these are the three aspects each of the beginning and the end. So let's talk about a couple things here. The phrase "to anoint the most holy" probably refers to the millennial temple. Ezekiel 41 to 46 talks about that. We may not get to that passage in particular, but we see the prophecy here looking forward to God's kingdom. And all of these aspects are really summarized in the Abrahamic covenant that we see in Genesis chapter 15, the Davidic covenant we see in 2 Samuel chapter 7, which promises a king, and then the new covenant of Jeremiah 31, which promises a lot of things, but is fulfilled in Christ when the old covenant, the Mosaic covenant, is put away, and the new covenant fulfilled in Christ comes. And so Israel and we are beneficiaries of the new covenant in Christ. But the covenants, the Abrahamic covenant that promises to the Jews a land, a great people, and all of this, a kingdom, is being fulfilled in these prophecies that Daniel's talking about here. So that's what Daniel's is looking at. Now, the question is, when do these years begin? If Daniel is giving us literal years, then we have to ask, when do these dates begin and when do they happen? And so let's look at some of these things. Now, it begins with this idea of a decree going out. And the Persians issued four decrees. And so historians, theologians have looked at each of these decrees and taken a look at them. The first decree went out from Cyrus and concerned the rebuilding of the temple. The second decree was issued by Darius and had reaffirmed the same first decree of the temple. The third decree was by Artaxerxes. It was only in the fourth decree that we see the rebuilding of Jerusalem. And that's what Daniel's talking about. So Daniel here says that the decree goes out for your holy city. The seven sevens are decreed for your people and your holy city. And then in verse 25, no one understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. And so what we're looking for is a decree which talks about the rebuilding of Jerusalem. And that we see on the chart dated there as March 5 of 444 B.C. And if you go to Nehemiah 2, and the chart's got that passage noted there, it is on that date when a decree goes out by Artaxerxes to rebuild Jerusalem. And so they had already had two decrees to rebuild the temple, the third decree to finance the temple, but now they say in this decree, go back and rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And so if Daniel is using that date as the beginning of these 69 weeks, and we're going to take the 7 and the 62, call them 69 weeks, that begins on March 5 of 444 B.C. And now the clock is ticking on these years. And so as you move forward, we're going to see how these years play out. Now, the reason he takes seven sevens, that's 49 years, is because that decree goes out on March 5, and 49 years later, we wind up at about the year 395 B.C. And in about the year 395 B.C., we get now to where Jerusalem is being rebuilt, and the temple is being rebuilt, so that's now being accomplished. And so those things are happening. The decree goes out, but now 49 years later, it's all being executed on. And that's why there's that segment out of it. But now continuing on, we add these other years. So we begin with the year 444 B.C. Now, you see the math underneath that part of the chart. 483 years times 369 days per year. 360 days. The reason 360 days are used, that's what the Jews use as their calendar years. Now, of course, we would all know that that would soon throw your calendar off very quickly. The winter and the summer months begin to get confused. And so they would add a 13th month every few years to kind of keep things on track. But in Revelation, we're going to see this, and you can see it, I think, on the right side of your chart. In Revelation 12, 6 and 13, 5, there it speaks of 42 months equaling 3.5 years. 1260 days. And if you take 42 and 30, you get 1260 days. And so we're still back to that 30-day months or 360-day years. So that's why we use that math. Now we get these total number of days, 173,880 days. You see that number? Now, if you begin counting on March 5 of 444 BC, and you go through the calendar, you wind up on March 30 of 33 AD. Now, what happened on that date? That would be the date that Christ entered into Jerusalem. The coming of the Anointed One is what we're looking for. And so again, in verse 25, no one understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem in March 5, 444, until the Anointed One, the ruler, comes, and that would be Christ, his triumphal entry, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. So there we have this prophecy pointing to that. So even if Daniel was dated in the year 200 BC, give it a very late date, 150 BC, this math now still overcomes that, because Daniel's still looking forward another 180 some years and pinpointing the date when the Messiah would enter in the triumphal entry. And so that's the date that we have there. So that's the significance of Daniel's 69 weeks of prophecy. Those things happen and are cut off there. Now, it tells us that after this happens, that the Messiah would be cut off. After the 69th seven, he'll be cut off. And so let me just read again. It will be the city will be rebuilt, and the streets and the trench, but in times of trouble. After, and I'm in verse 26, after the 62 sevens, the Anointed One will be cut off and will have nothing. And that's a discussion, a picture of Christ being crucified. So notice, he doesn't say, you know, it's the word after is kind of important there, because it's after the 69 weeks are done, which is a triumphal entry. It's after that that the Messiah is cut off, and that's the crucifixion. And then it continues, the people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now that's a picture of what happened in the year 70 AD when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem. And so we see Jerusalem being destroyed after the 69 weeks. But notice we're not yet in the 70th week. And that's why scholars now look at this and separate the 70th week and don't have it run contiguous to the 69 weeks. And so it's after the end of the 69, there's a gap. And in that gap, the Anointed One is cut off, the city of Jerusalem is destroyed, and then somewhere we're going to see the 70th week begin. And that's where we're going to get into the book of Revelation, which is going to talk about some of that content and some other things as well that kind of help tie this all together. Now, and I don't want to get off sidetracked on this, but this is the typical view of a pre-millennial, pre-tribulational view. Pre-millennial means that the tribulation will happen before, and the rapture will happen before the millennium. That's the premillennial view. A postmillennial view says that the millennium happens first, and then at the end of that millennium, Christ returns. The amillennial view says that we're actually in the millennium now in a spiritual sense. But the pre-tribulational view says that the rapture, and on your chart, if you see this little arrow, that's a picture of the rapture, Christ coming down and meeting the saints in the air, as is described in 1 Thessalonians 4 and 1 Corinthians 15. The rapture happens at the beginning of the tribulation or prior to it. There may be a gap of some days, but not much. The rapture, then the seven-year tribulation, and then the second coming happens at the end. And on the other side, the other chart I gave you, that's a little bit more expanded. We can see that. So you can see that. But let's stay with Daniel 9 for just a moment and finish up what Daniel 9 is telling us. So we see these events sort of being laid out. Now again, in this passage of Daniel 9, after the 62 sevens, the Anointed One will be cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler will come and will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolation have been decreed. And in verse 27, he, now, some conservative, amillennialists, they're good people, view that he will confirm a covenant as being Christ confirming a covenant, the new covenant, with the church. But I think we take it better as he being the one who destroys and the Antichrist, he will confirm a covenant with many for 1-7. And so this 1-7, or the 70th week, is being separated out. And so on your chart, again, you see it's labeled 69 weeks up here. That's the 69 weeks. This is the 70th week that happens after the rapture, the 70th week. And at the beginning of that 70 weeks, Antichrist confirms a covenant. Now, I didn't write that on there and should have. You see in the middle, the Antichrist breaks that treaty, breaks that covenant. So at the beginning of the 7 years, the tribulation, there's a covenant. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1-7. In the middle of the 7, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on a wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. And the end that is decreed poured out on him is really all that the last chapters of the book of Revelation are explaining to us and discussing. So on this chart, we're now in the 70th week. There's a middle when this covenant that's made, this treaty that's made at the beginning, is now abrogated and ended. After that, the second 3.5 years are severe. The 7 years total is often described as a tribulation, the last 3.5 years as the Great Tribulation, because in those last 3.5 years, the intensity of the tribulation increases dramatically. If you're familiar with the book of Revelation, and we're going to begin that study in a couple of weeks, there's three series of judgments, and I have them noted here at the bottom of this chart, and the tribulation. In chapters 6, 1 to 17, there's the seven seals. And these are bad things that happen. The seventh seal is broken, and we begin the second cycle of trumpets. And there's seven trumpets. And then with the seventh trumpet, there's seven bowls. The seals, trumpets, and bowls, each of them, the first of the seals, trumpets, and bowls, looks the same, the second. And so we'll talk next month about how we might organize those. But whether you view them sequentially as 21 events of increasing intensity or as seven sort of a circular or spiral sort of a description, either way, it's apparent that as the tribulation continues toward the last 3.5 years, the intensity of its difficulty is dramatically increased. And that's what Daniel's talking about here at the end of Daniel 9:27. Until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. And so that's Daniel tying in with Revelation. Daniel is really the key which organizes and helps explain concerning the dates and the structure what the book of Revelation lays out in much, much greater detail. So with this 70th week, we have the 7 years, the rapture happening at the beginning of it, and then the second coming happening at the end of the 7 years. And so if we have the rapture happening here, Christ comes for the church, and the church meets him in the air, and then spends the 7 years outside of the tribulation, and then comes with Christ at the end. And so this is the second coming. Now that's the pre-tribulational view, that the church escapes the 7 years of the tribulation. So real quickly, let's turn over and look at the other chart so we can kind of fit this view in here. So you see the pre-tribulational chart here. These two events, which are the rapture, here we might say is the rapture, and then here is the return at the end. But these two together are the second coming. And often people of the pre-tribulational view speak of the rapture as the second coming. The pre-tribulational view separates it as two aspects, the rapture and the revelation or the return at the end. So the second coming has two parts. And that's illustrated on this top chart as well. Now, just to kind of complete a discussion on this part of the chart, we won't spend time on it. At the end of the second coming, Revelation 20, we see the millennium beginning, the thousand-year millennium. And at the end of that thousand years in chapter 21 of Revelation, the new heavens and new earth of eternity. Now, if you look at the second view underneath it, the post-tribulational view, you see this one difference. Everything it lays out basically the same, except that the rapture and the return both happen at the end of the 7 years. And so with that, it simplifies it because Christ comes and we meet him in the air and we come right down for the beginning of the millennium at that moment. And so that's what that view is describing. That's a view called historic premillennialism. And it goes back a lot of years. Both of these views do, and we'll talk about this in a moment. But that's the post-tribulational view, that the rapture and the second coming happen at the same event at the end of the 7 years. So having briefly talked about those charts, does anybody have any questions or anything to add to that so far?
I've heard the first 3.5 years of the tribulation described as the wrath of man, and the last 3.5 is the wrath of God. Are you familiar with that? Does that make any sense?
We'll talk about that in some measure in the next few minutes as well. The tribulation period is a period of wrath. Let's move in. We're going to move in that topic now, and we'll deal with it there.
Yeah, just one comment. It's a specific thing that the Antichrist confirms the covenant with Israel. It's a specific point of time.
Yeah.
And that occurs before the first 3.5 years.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if we don't see the Antichrist doing that, then the tribulation hasn't started yet.
That would be the idea, right. So some might create a gap between the rapture and the beginning of the tribulation. It doesn't seem like there would be much of a gap or should be much of a gap in that. But those are the events we have. Now, let's talk in particular about the nature of the tribulation and the rapture, as Wanda was getting at, and how this might all kind of fit together. So let me first give some arguments for a pre-tribulational view that says that the rapture happens at the beginning of the 7 years and the church escapes from the 7 years only to return at the end. And so the tribulation is a period of wrath. What Juan is indicating is the first 3.5 years, there is a difference. Clearly the last 3.5 years is the great outpouring of God's wrath. Is God's wrath in the first 3.5 years or the wrath of man? Obviously, with the Antichrist being in control, it's going to be a bad time, as the book of Revelation describes. So let's see how the pre-tribulational arguments lay out, and then we'll talk about some post-tribulational issues that they raise, and then how this might also be. Now, what I've given you here, again on this chart, the tribulational views, is the pre-trib and the post-trib. There's two other views that I didn't want to chart out because they're kind of easy to explain. If you take the pre-tribulational view and move the rapture from the beginning into the middle, then you have the mid-tribulational view. And so you can easily move the rapture over 3.5 years and put it in the middle. And so that would get maybe to what Wanda's indicating as well, that the church is promised to escape from the wrath of God. And if that begins in the middle, then the rapture doesn't have to happen until the middle. And so that's a third view, that the rapture happens in the middle of the tribulation. A fourth view is what's called the pre-wrath rapture. And that doesn't identify it necessarily with the middle, but sometime before the great outpouring of God's wrath. So each of those three views anyway see the church being taken out of the tribulation to protect it from the wrath of God, the outpouring of God's wrath. Only the post-tribulational view sees the church in the tribulation during the outpouring of God's wrath at that time. But then we got to understand, we'll see what how they view it as well here in just a moment. But those are the four views, the pre-trib, the post-trib, which are like the ends, the mid-trib and the pre-wrath are variations of the pre-trib view, just moving it into the middle. So there's a couple of arguments when we talk about a pre-tribulational rapture, the rapture happening before the tribulation. There's some arguments that are made. First is what Ben raised last week or mentioned. What about history? You know, where's the church always been? Now, on the one hand, you can go back in church history and there's some writings where it sounds like it's a pre-tribulational view. In a particular early writing called The Shepherd of Hermas, there's a discussion in there which could be read to understand it that way. And maybe there's that, but there's really not that much. And in part, the early church wasn't really dealing with eschatology in this sense. It was dealing with surviving the persecutions, expanding the church, spreading the gospel. That's what they were working on. They weren't charting out the things like we have the luxury of doing tonight. And then I was thinking also, the in church history, the theology doesn't really begin to develop these topics immediately. If you go back to the Council of Nicaea in the year 325 AD, we're a couple hundred years into the church. What are they arguing about? What are they really trying to refine? They're trying to understand not only the doctrine of God, but now the doctrine of the Trinity, as we have Christ and the Spirit as part God, or not part God, that's bad language, as God themselves, as this is consolation. You know, how are we understanding the Trinity? And so the Council of Nicaea is dealing with that. It's dealing with Christological issues, who Christ is, how does he have two natures in one person. That's what they're really trying to refine. Later issues of ecclesiology, you know, church structure, you know, what are bishops and deacons and presbyters and elders and all of this? How do they structure? The Catholic Church becomes predominant and has its view. The Reformation may change a lot of that. But it's really not until much later in church history where they begin dealing with these issues of eschatology. But it was with Augustine in the 400s. And when you get to Augustine, things begin to change because, you know, all of a sudden, one of the most brilliant men of all of history becomes a Christian and begins to write prolifically. And so people very quickly just believe what Augustine said. And he did many, many great things. He turned the church and understanding of the consequences of sin. But he also had some confusing things with ecclesiology. But he then took more of an amillennial view, that the millennium discussed in Revelation is a spiritually fulfilled in the church itself. And so that's where they see these promises being fulfilled. But the premillennial view sees that as something still in the future. The pre-trib view sees the tribulation as a time when God deals again with the Jews. So in this church age, he's dealing with the Gentiles. In the tribulation, his attention is taken back towards the Jews in particular. So historical arguments, what did the early church believe? Those are fun to discuss perhaps, but they're not conclusive because the question is always going to be, what does the Bible have to say? Not what can we extract from some particular writing somewhere in history. So what does the Bible say? Another view that we talked about last time briefly was the doctrine of imminence. Christ could come back at any time. Well, the question is to find a passage that says that. And it's not easy to find a passage which clearly states it that way. In fact, imminence is more of a doctrine that flows from an understanding of the rapture happening at the beginning of the tribulation. Because if that's the case, then there's nothing that needs to occur before the rapture happens. That means Christ could come at any time. So imminence is more of a corollary that flows from the understanding that the rapture is the next event to happen. It's not really an argument for the fact that the rapture is the next event to happen. It flows from it instead. Because there's not really any great passage which this clearly lays out that Christ could come back at any moment. Everything that's discussed speaks of it coming speedily, and that's all true. But it really is a corollary that comes out of it. So the first weaker arguments from the church fathers, that doesn't help us very much. The doctrine of imminence doesn't get us very far. And so those are some of the weaker arguments. Now, There's other arguments that between the pre-trib view and the post-trib view that kind of match up against each other. The next one is going to be in Revelation 19 and 20. Revelation 19 and 20 we'll get to when we work through Revelation. We'll spend time on that in particular. But in Revelation 19 and 20, we have a description here of these last events and the millennium and all of this. When you work your way, first of all, if you're a post-trib advocate, that the tribulation that the rapture happens at the end of the tribulation, and if the book of Revelation is a description of the tribulation, you would have expected to see more discussion of the church in the book of Revelation. But we don't really see that very much at all. The church isn't discussed in the book of Revelation after chapters 2 and 3, which is specifically just talking about the seven churches. In chapter 4 until chapter 18, there's no discussion of the church there at all. And so the church itself is not discussed in Revelation. So with that, it's not until you get to 19 and 20 when the church comes back into the picture again. Now, when you go to the Olivet Discourse, and that's a teaching that Jesus gave in Matthew 24 and 25. Remember in Matthew 24 and 25, the disciples asked, what are the signs of your coming and the signs of these times? And Jesus goes into this very long discussion there. And maybe next week or so we'll try and touch on some of that, structure of that. But that's kind of like Daniel 9 and Revelation. It lays out certain events. But what Jesus is talking about in the Olivet Discourse of Matthew 24 and 25 is the events within the tribulation itself, the things to look for within the tribulation. And so for our purposes, we don't see the church found within the tribulation in that sense. And then in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, let me just read this passage, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, and our being gathered to him, and Paul's writing to this church at Thessalonica. We ask you, brothers, not to become easily unsettled or alarmed by some prophecy or report or letter supposed to have come from us, saying that the day of the Lord has already come. So when Paul writes, it sounds like somebody has told the church at Thessalonica, the day of the Lord's already come. The rapture's already happened. Now, this has the people in Thessalonica distressed. And so he says, don't be distressed about it. Don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed. And that's the Antichrist that Revelation talks about. The man of lawlessness is the one who establishes a covenant at the beginning of the tribulation. Until he is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. He will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worship, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. And so that's, again, Paul talking about that abomination of desolation, when after the seven-year covenant is made, it's broken in the middle, and he sets himself up as God himself. So Paul tells the church, don't worry about that, that's not happened yet. Don't you remember that when I was with you, I used to tell you these things? And now you know what is holding him back, so that he may be revealed at the proper time. For the secret power of lawlessness is already at work, but the one who now holds it back will continue to do so until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord Jesus will overthrow with the breath of his mouth and destroy by the splendor of his coming. And so Paul explains to Thessalonians that the restrainer, the spirit, we suppose, is holding back evil until this the 70th year begins, the last 7 years. Then the spirit's removed. And if the spirit's removed, then presumably the church is as well, because we are with the spirit. We can't be here if the spirit's not. So the spirit's removed, the church is removed. And at that point, the man of lawlessness reveals himself, and that's the Antichrist. And so the question is, if the church at Thessalonica were post-trib, and they were in the middle of this suffering, thinking that the man of lawlessness is here, they wouldn't be distressed by that because they would already know that that was coming, and they should be then glorying it because now we're going to have the return and the end of the tribulation. But they were distressed by it because they thought that then those who had died had missed out on something. And so Paul writes to them to encourage them not to be distressed by it. The day of the Lord hasn't happened, and so they shouldn't be panicked. So the post-trib view would have the church not being distressed by it, but they should be happy by it if they're going through these circumstances. So these are some of these are like arguments from silence again. If the church were to endure the tribulation, if Paul were post-trib and the church were to go through the tribulation, you would expect in his epistles more discussion of what the church should expect and anticipate as they endure the trials of the tribulation. We would expect that the rapture and the explanation for the rapture would be an explanation that it will come after the tribulation. But that's not what we find, so we don't see it. So it's an argument from silence, but it doesn't appear that Paul talks about the church undergoing the tribulation itself. Now again, as I mentioned, the church is not mentioned in Revelation chapter 4 through 18. And so as we go through Revelation in a few weeks, we'll see there a lot of things discussed. The 144,000, the 12 tribes, all of which seem to be related towards the Jews in Israel. And so the book of Revelation seems to have as its focus more the nation of Israel itself. And the church is not the primary focus of it. And then again, as I mentioned, there's not a lot of warnings about this impending trial for the church. Paul does give warnings. He warns us to beware of false prophets. He warns us to be beware of ungodly living. He does talk about the present tribulation we have, this time in which we live, in which there will be difficulties, there will be suffering. We know all about that. Paul talks about that. Peter talks about that. First Peter's all about that, basically. We're undergoing troubles in this life. That's to be sure. But that's different from what the rapture seems to be rescuing us from. Again, the rapture seems to be not very consequential in a post-tribulational view, because it doesn't rescue us from anything. In the pre-tribulational view, the rapture is pictured as Christ coming for his church, his bride, to remove us from this period of tribulation. So it has a benefit if it happens at the beginning, because it accomplishes that purpose to remove the church from the tribulation. But if it happens at the end of the tribulation, then it doesn't really accomplish a purpose, because the rapture coming at the end is followed up with the return and our entrance into the millennium already. So the rapture itself doesn't really do anything. If we meet the Lord in the air, we return to the ground immediately for the millennial part of God's program. So the rapture doesn't seem to serve a purpose. But when the rapture is discussed in 2 Thessalonians as well, it appears to serve the purpose of rescuing the church, protecting the church from this time. And then, again, in the Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24 and 25, that seems to be a picture, a discussion of the tribulation. At the end of the tribulation, we have this separating of the sheep and the goats. And that is the separation of those saints and non-believers through the tribulation. It appears that during the tribulation, although believers are taken out at the beginning, new believers are added during the tribulation. And so others may be saved during the tribulation. Jews who are being saved, 144,000 being a picture of that, and others. So we have this remnant of those believers. The purpose of Matthew 25 discussing the sheep and the goats being separated would then perhaps have the purpose of re-separating those who have become believers and unbelievers in the tribulation. The rapture would then not serve that purpose. For the preacher view, the saints are taken up, and so there's this initial separation, the first part of this first resurrection, and then new believers added, and a need now for a second separation because the circumstances have changed during the 7 years. There's additional believers added during the seven-year tribulation. And so the sheep and the goats at the end would not make as much sense or serve as much purpose during the with a post-tribulational view. Now, let's just talk about one more argument that might seem somewhat technical, but that's what the arguments are. And I mentioned last week that for every one of these arguments, there's counter-arguments, and they go on and on and on. But here's this final argument, and it's in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 10. And this is a passage which all sides agree has to be decided and understood. So Paul is writing, John is writing to the church at Philadelphia. And it says, since you have kept my command to endure patiently, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that is going to come upon the whole world to test those who live on the earth. Now, from a pre-tribulational view, we would say that that's saying that the Lord will remove us and protect us from the hour of trial or the tribulation. I will keep you from the hour of trial that's going to come. And we understand that to mean that he keeps us from the hour of trial or the seven-year tribulation by means of the rapture. The post-trib view is that he simply protects us within the tribulation. Although the church is on earth during the tribulation, we're protected from the wrath of God during the tribulation. And so the word that's used here is going to be an important word. The Greek word that's used here is the Greek word ek. E-C, or E-K. And so, ek is the word that's used here. And I'll spell it out in English. Ek, to keep you from. Now, the thing about the word ek is it can mean, to illustrate this, to keep you from like this, or it can mean to keep you out of this way, so you're not in it. So one is the idea of emergence through it, and that's the post-trib view. The other use of ek is to keep out of entirely, to keep out of the mess entirely. And so that's the pre-trib view. Now, that's the one word that is there, ek. One word that would have clarified it is if Paul had used the word apo, apo, which means from. Apo could only mean that. It never means from within. It always means from without. And so if John had used this word, then we would have known the pre-trib view works. However, if he wanted to give a post-trib view, there's N and ace as well that he could have used, and that would have then been in the tribulation, kept us safe in the tribulation. But he didn't use those words either. John happened to use the one word which leaves something of an ambiguity. The preposition itself is ambiguous. The word again used here is tereo, to keep from. And so you ask, what does that mean? We see it as being kept from, safe out. There's one other word here, D-I-A. Which has the idea of through. Dia is through, kept through. Ace is in and N is in. These two words basically mean the same thing, in and in. But tereo means to keep. And there's a few places that it's used. And so let me just point to a few of these real quickly. In John 17:5, Jesus says, I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. And so here it seems to be clear that Jesus is asking that we be kept from the evil one. Now, this is the word that we would mean from. Apo means from. Ek is used in John, however. But it clearly means kept from the evil one, because we know the church is not under the authority of Satan. He says again, I do not ask you that you take them out of the world, so we're in the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. So we know that we're protected from Satan in this world, even within it. In 1 John 5:19, John says, we know that we are from God, and the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. And so in 1 John, John makes it clear that believers are from God, and that the rest of the world lies under the power of the evil one. So there's at least this theological truth in play that as believers, we are protected from the evil one. Now, when we come to this passage again in Revelation 3:10, it raises a question about which view fits better this. If God is keeping us from the evil one, and this tribulation is the age in which God's wrath is being poured out and Satan is active in the world, it seems better to understand generally that we're kept from it by being on the outside of it, and not simply by being protected, as a post-trib view would say, in it. So the post-trib puts the church in it, the pre-trib view puts the church outside of it. There's also the question of martyrs. In Revelation 6 and Revelation 7, there's a description there of martyrs, people who are dying because of their faith. And so it appears now that we have people who are becoming believers in the tribulation. But if there's martyrs in the tribulation, then it appears that God is in fact not keeping the church or those believers safe from Satan in the tribulation. So there's a couple other things we could say. We're running out of time. 1 John 14 also has this picture here of Christ going to prepare a place for us. The point of all of this is to say that perhaps the pre-trib view has better strengths, but it's not a decisively decided view. There are arguments that a post-trib view can come up with that also have some staying power. And that's why there's the debate. It's not clearly decided one way or the other. I think most who are part of our church have been pre-trib historically, and that may be the case. But one other aspect is, I'll say this last thing, what Christ says in Matthew 24 and 25, the Olivet Discourse, describing the end of the age, again, there he doesn't describe the church being a part of it. In 1 Thessalonians 4:13 to 18, and I wrote that passage on your chart there so you have that reference, but in 1 Thessalonians 4:13, we have this picture of Christ coming and rescuing us from the church. Now, it's possible that God could keep us safe through the church, in the church, through the tribulation, as this view, the post-trib, but it seems better that we're simply removed out of it. And what that also does is it provides a time frame during the 7 years when other events can happen. And so we'll see this next week, the marriage supper of the Lamb, some other events that are occurring concurrent with the tribulation period. We'll talk about that and add that to the charts next time. But we're out of, does anybody have any questions tonight on that?
No. Is there any other precedent in prophecy that you're aware of where you don't have things running contiguous? Like what I mean is the, you know, the 7 weeks of seven.
The separation of events?
Like the 69 weeks, and then all of a sudden there's this unexplained gap between the cross and the church age, and then you pick up with the 70th week. Just seems odd. I know that's a pretty basic question.
No, but there is one other example, and that's that so many of the Old Testament prophecies of the coming Messiah was confusing to the Jews because it talked about a coming Messiah in humility, and one coming in great glory. And they weren't sure how to put it together. And that's why the Jews of Jesus' day thought that Christ would be instituting his kingdom now. You know, you've come now. We got to get this thing going. And then Christ says, no, not yet. There's a separation. And so many of those Old Testament prophecies were looking forward and saw a time of humility, but also a time of great glory. And it's been described as like a mountain peak. You know, if you take a mountain peak, you hike in the mountains. And, you know, here you are, I'm sorry, to critic. Yeah. But from this guy's view here, it's hard to see the difference in those peaks. They're distant, right? But it's only after you cross this first peak that you see how low this one is and how different that one is. And so perhaps, theologically speaking, the prophecies that look forward to the coming Messiah saw the lowly Messiah here and the great glory one down there, but prophetically from Isaiah, for example, it was hard to see how these could both be true because the peaks look the same. But perhaps after we cross this peak, we see now, oh, now it's understood. And that's where we're at. And so I think that's why the 70th week of Daniel is separated out, looking for this man of lawlessness to establish his covenant, which we view as having not happened yet. Any other questions? Yeah, Bob.
Let's get back to imminence. In Acts 2, the Lord clearly says that the times of season are known to the Father, knowing knows when coming back, etc., etc. And so if the mid-tribute were correct, then all you'd have to do is take a look back at yesterday's newspaper and see, oh, here's a covenant established now with Israel. Oh, good. Exactly 3 years and 364 days from now, I'm going to be raptured.
Yeah.
See, that destroys imminence.
That is a difficulty for the post-tribute, yeah.
Right.
Because you would see it already happen. You could start counting off the days. The mid-tribute, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, with the breakout coming, you'd see that. And that's why the amillennial view spiritualizes it and kind of, you know, it doesn't pick dates and events for any of it. And so they don't have that as a disability because they solve it by softening its point anyway.
Doesn't a lot of things have to happen, like the temple has to be rebuilt and a bunch of other things before that
stage. Yeah.
So, I mean, the temple hasn't been rebuilt.
And that hasn't yet, yeah.
It could be done in 6 months. They've got everything ready to go.
Yeah, so there is all of that. I mean, that could happen, and it could happen quickly. The rapture could happen separate from the rebuilding of the temple and the beginning of the 7 years. And so there could be a time delay in there. So theoretically speaking, we would say that Christ could come tonight without the events starting the 7 years having already happened. If it were to happen, you know, if the temple were built, then we might see that coming as more imminent. But I think we can separate those out. The 70th week still may be gapped between the rapture and the beginning of the 70th week. And so that's why that might still be ambiguous. But you're right. Before the 70th week begins, you've got to have that happen. Yeah. Any other questions or thoughts? All right, so that's the chart for tonight. Next week it will be an entirely different chart that kind of continues it on, dealing with the issues of the millennium, the millennial views, Israel in the tribulation, then the millennium, and then the Revelation 21. So we'll touch on some of that, but because we're going to cover it in much greater detail when we do Revelation, we don't want to take all the steam out of that because we're going to cover it in greater detail in greater context as we go through Revelation very quickly, frankly. 7 weeks in Revelation is going to be very fast, but I think it'll be good. All right, well, again, thank you for coming. If you have any questions, let me know. Email me if you like. Rick@carmichael.org is an email that'll get to me, and we'll talk next week. But thank you again.